This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
And welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. I'm going to give you some advance notice. You're going to have to get thee to a quiet room and saddle up close, get nice and intimate and up close and personal with your radio receiver, because we're going to have a couple of low talkers in studio, and that's by design. I'll get to more of that in just a moment. Welcome to The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Last night, and Friday night, of course, sitting in, hosting Coast to Coast, and last night I happened to mention being a Canuck of a certain age, and I remember in public school, going back to, let's say, 1971 Echo Place Public School in Brantford, and of course before the school day would begin, we would sing God Save the Queen in school. In fact, I don't think O Canada became our official national anthem until, I want to say, about 1980. Anyway, we only sang the first verse, as far as I can remember. God save our gracious queen, long live our noble queen, God save the queen, send her victorious, happy and glorious, long to reign over us, God save the queen. That's all there was, and I didn't realize until recently, there are other verses. And the second one, which I've just discovered, and the fourth, I found this very interesting. And it's rather fitting, given the subject matter that we discuss on this program. Listen to the lyrics in verse 2. O Lord, our God, arise, scatter her enemies, and make them fall. Confound their politics, frustrate their knavish tricks. Owe thee our hopes we fix, God save us all. Confound their politics, frustrate their knavish tricks. Sounds like the composer, and there are various theories as to who that was, but it sounds like the composer was worried about some conspiracy being launched against Britannia, does it not? But listen, it gets better. Listen to the fourth verse. Again, God save the queen. You may not remember this from school. From every latent foe, from the assassin's blow, God save the queen. O'er her thine arm extend, for Britain's sake defend, our mother, prince, and friend, God save the queen. If anyone can explain the context of those lyrics, I'd love to know. Whose knavish tricks was the composer speaking of? And what's all this God save the queen or the king at the time? It was, when it was first performed in 1745, it would have been God save the king. But what's all this about from every latent foe and from the assassin's blow? Again, sounds like there was a conspiracy afoot. Little did I know that when I was singing God Save the Queen back in Echo Place Public School in the early 70s, one day I'd be peddling conspiracy theories on the airwaves. But here we are. Follow the truth, friends. If you haven't ordered your passes to my all-day conference on Sunday, November the 16th, you better do it soon. Time is a-wasting. And we're only offering a limited number of tickets so we can keep this thing reasonably intimate. So go to followthetruth.tv, check out the list of incredible speakers I'm bringing to town. Roswell investigator Don Schmidt, retired U.S. Army Sergeant Jim Penniston, who was a key witness to the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, Professor Ronald Mallett from the University of Connecticut to discuss time travel, Jim Elvidge on The Matrix, Patty Greer, one of the world's great circle chasers. I'm talking about crop circles. And, very excited, we've recently added another truly remarkable individual to the lineup, and she's standing by in studio with a special guest. We're going to spend the next hour with her. Let me get back to Follow the Truth for just a second. Again, it's being held in Oshawa at the Regent Theater, which is a beautifully restored theater down on King Street in downtown Oshawa. I believe it was on the vaudeville circuit about 80 years ago. So I'll be up on stage presenting these remarkable people. And then after the conference, there'll be a special intimate meet and greet upstairs at the theater. So listen, I need you to do this. I need you to call the box office, 905-721-3399. Use the code word Roswell and receive a special 25% discount off the price of your passes, Roswell. And we'll put the first 200 tickets sold into a draw. The first 200 tickets will be placed in a draw. Prize number one, you get to sit in on this radio show. You'll sit right next to me in the studio, co-host the conspiracy show. You can even help produce the show, pick the guests. Prize number two, dinner with yours truly. I'll pick up the tab. Hell, I'll even carry the tray. Not to worry. I'm going to pick a nice place. I'll pick a nice spot. You and a friend and me and maybe, who knows, the mighty Aphrodite if she's in town. Prize number three, you get to hang out in the green room with me backstage and our great lineup of speakers. You get individual access to these amazing people. You get lunch, copies of our speakers' books, DVDs, and a copy of my two-volume collection of Strange Planet. So don't wait. I want to see you there. I want to put a face to all of you, my wonderful listeners. The box office number again, 905-721-3399. Call first thing tomorrow before you forget and you miss out. This is going to be a truly unique experience. Think of TED Talks or Idea City for the UFO paranormal conspiracy-minded. And as I say, one of our featured guests for Follow the Truth is here, Debbie Papadakis. She was destined to be a teacher, a healer, and a lifelong student of the human mind. At a very young age, she carried a deep passion and curiosity about the human mind and human personalities. And what started out as a career in psychotherapy exposed Debbie to the study of human dynamics, where she recognized an increased need in employing hypnotherapy and past life exploration techniques to treat her clients. This led to her advanced practice by becoming a Reiki master, a past life regression trainer, practitioner, a neuro-linguistic programming practitioner, trainer, a timeline therapy practitioner, trainer, master practitioner practicing counseling psychology. She's got a resume that's as long as a first down in the CFL, let me tell you. Anyway, she's here once again we'll talk a little bit about what she's going to be doing at Follow the Truth, the Conspiracy Show Summit, but we're conducting another in our series of live past life regressions, live on the air. And just seated to Debbie's left, first of all, Debbie, how are you? Welcome.
Hi, Lisa. Welcome, and hi to all the listeners.
Seated to your left is our subject for tonight, and just before the show, back in the boardroom down the hall, you placed Paul,
yes,
Coitus, in a deep hypnotic state. In fact, my intern, Albert, was leading him by the hand, and I've never seen Paul this relaxed. I know Paul because he is my partner in Follow the Truth. He is producing the Conspiracy Show Summit, and he's also the associate dean at Durham College in the School of Media, Art, and Design, where I happen to teach part-time. So Paul is, as I say, I've never seen him more relaxed. I mean, he is in a deep state, is he not, Debbie?
Yes, he's in a very deep state. And a couple of minutes ago, he had some tears.
We should, cards on the table here, total disclosure. Not everyone, as you know, Debbie, not everyone is a candidate to be placed in a deep meditative state. Not everyone can be hypnotized.
That's correct.
So, you know, before we do this on the air, we don't just do it cold. You know, we have to determine whether people are good candidates. So
that's right.
Paul came down to see you at the Hypno-Healing Institute.
That's right. Just we did some testings to make sure we have he's receptive to this kind of work in order to bring him here today and to go to a deep trance and explore his past lives.
And so he's going to undergo what we hope is a past life regression. We don't know necessarily. I mean, we are working without a net here. This is radio, folks.
That's right. That's right. Well, a minute ago, when I asked him where he was, he told me he was in India, but it's been now 20 minutes. I don't know where he is.
Now, Paul, as far as I know, has never undergone prior to, I guess it was this past Thursday, has never undergone undergone hypnosis.
That's right.
And he certainly never sort of delved into past life regression. No. Now, he's laying back. I'm going to get him. Are you able to get him to lean forward and speak more directly into the mic?
Okay, Paul, I'm going to count from one to three. At three, you will come. You will lean
but I need you
forward.
On the mic at the same
just
time, Debbie.
Just a little forward, and the minute you're leaning forward, you're going much deeper than you're right now. One, two, three. Just forward, and you're going deeper and deeper while you're doing this. That's right.
And I need you on the mic, too, Debbie. Can you hear me?
Safe. That's right.
There he is.
Wonderful, yes.
Okay, you have to stay on the mic, too,
yes.
If you can hear me. Okay. Do you want to strap on the headset?
If I have this, it's better.
Yeah. Albert. In the other room. Can you hear me, Albert? Can you come in and make sure that Debbie's headset is turned up? Because she needs to hear me. We don't need a headset on Paul.
Okay.
Albert, my trusty intern, joining us from Ryerson. Albert, her headset, not too loud. Okay, can you hear me now, Debbie, through your headset?
Oh, yes.
Excellent.
No,
okay, so you stay on mic. All right, so where are we going to take Paul?
Well, I'm going to count from one to three, and I'm going to ask Paul to go to the place where he was a few minutes ago, and I really don't know where he was. One, two, three, Paul, just go back where you were a few minutes ago and start talking, explaining to us where you were and what you are watching, what are you seeing, and what you're experiencing. Take deep breaths while you're doing that.
He is relaxed. He is really deep. He's not asleep, is he?
No, he's not asleep. He's going to start talking now. It takes him time. He's a very deep level, so he's... Where are you, Paul?
I'm in India.
And what is happening around? Just
speak into the mic, Debbie.
What is happening there?
It's very dark, and there's a lot. There's so many stars. I've never seen so many stars. It's beautiful.
And what are you doing there?
It's a party.
What kind of party is that?
It's a wedding.
Wedding? Who's getting married?
I don't know them. I don't know why I'm here, but I'm at this wedding.
Take a couple of deep breaths and just look around. And I'm going to count from one to three. You will know how you know those people and who they are. In fact, you'll know your name. One, two, three. What is your name?
I'm Tom.
Tom. And how do you know those people who... How do you end up in that wedding?
I'm taking pictures.
Oh, you're a photographer.
He's the wedding photographer, I guess.
Well, I'm a journalist.
Journalist.
And... Tell us more about your life. How old are you, a man, female?
I'm a man.
Man, how old are you?
I'm 25.
25.
What part of India is he in, Debbie?
You ask.
Can I ask him directly? All right.
Actually, Paul, Richard is going to be asking you questions, and I just accept those questions as you accepting my questions. So you can.
Should I refer to him as Tom? Can
yes.
I? I should
yes.
speak directly
yes.
to Tom.
Yes.
All right. Not Paul, but Tom.
Yes, yes.
Tom, do you have a sense of what part of India you're in? Is it the south? Is it the north?
I've never been here before, and it's the south, and I'm on assignment. I got to take some pictures, but it's you know, I don't know these people, but it's beautiful here. I've never seen something so beautiful. There's so many stars. I'm wearing like khaki pants. I have very long hair.
What year is it? How do we find that out, Debbie?
He's going to talk. Just as the information is coming to him, 1, 2, 3. You have the information. What year is it?
This is 1960.
1960.
So who's getting married? Why are these people so important that there's a journalist covering the story?
I'm just here to tell stories. Why am I here? I love it, though. It's a great place.
So these aren't necessarily famous people. He's sort of documenting, what, a day in the life of India?
Well, you ask him and he'll tell you.
Tom, are you on assignment?
I'm traveling around.
For whom? National Geographic? What? Who?
I'm just taking pictures for myself, but I want people to see these pictures someday.
All right, listen, we got to take a time out, Debbie. Stay put. Tom, Paul, stay put. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show, a live past life regression on the air. Stay with us. All right, welcome back. In studio, Debbie Papadakis, who will be one of our featured speakers at Follow the Truth, The Conspiracy Show Summit, a past life regression therapist, and in studio as well, our subject tonight is Paul Koidis, who is actually the producer of Follow the Truth, The Conspiracy Show Summit, and he is in a deep, deep meditative state. He is under hypnosis, and he's talking about his sojourn in India, in southern India, and he has indicated that his name is Tom. He seems to be a photojournalist, and it is the year 1960, and he is at the present time experiencing or re-experiencing a wedding where he's taking pictures. Debbie, what else can we find out about Tom?
Where are those pictures in this current time? Those pictures, do they exist somewhere?
No. He's shaking his head no.
What else is happening there, Tom?
I'm not there anymore.
Where are you now?
It's daytime. It's very bright, and I'm surrounded by a lot of colors.
Mm-hmm.
There's different color, purple, there's gold, there's elephants, a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hot.
And what is the event there? How did you end up there?
I live here.
I live there. And do you have a family? Do you have a...
Yes.
Yes. Tell us about your family.
I have a wife.
Uh-huh.
I can see her.
Is there anybody in these areas where you are that you recognize them from this current life?
Yes.
Tell me who is there.
Interesting.
My father-in-law.
My father-in-law. And what is the relationship you have and that... life that you know, you are in India.
He is my father.
He is my father.
So his current father in life, in this life.
This life is father-in-law and that life was a father.
Interesting.
Now, there was, in order to come to this life again with the same people, we usually have some contract make, something to be learned, so we come back again. I'm going to count from 1 to 3, I would like you to tell us, what was the contract that you guys had between the two of you? What was for you guys to learn so you came back in this current life? 1, 2, 3.
It's about love.
It's about love. And once you learn about love, both of you, what are you going to do with this information?
Everything's okay. It's about love.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't worry so much.
Mm. Shouldn't worry so much.
Does he have children? Tom, do you have children?
Tom, yeah.
I'm not Tom.
Who are you right now?
I'm Raja.
I'm Raja now.
What happened?
Did you go to another past life?
Yes.
And what year is this, Raja?
This is 1700 something.
1700 something. Okay, I'm going to count from 1 to 3. You will know the exact year. 1, 2, 3.
1750.
1750. And what is your occupation at this time?
I live in the village and people are coming to me with questions.
The questions are towards what kind subject? What is your...
Their problems. They have problems.
And who are you? Like, what kind work you do? You're helping them, but in what way?
I'm telling them. I'm giving them advice. I'm telling them how to solve their problems.
Are you from a wealthy family?
Oh. Yeah. Well, better than the other ones.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of advice you given them?
Everything.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a family there?
I have a wife.
Mm-hmm. How about children?
No.
No. Have you done anything in that life that was so significant that the information exists today? Let's say wrote a book or
I see my books.
My books. Okay. Can you look at one of them and see what's the title?
I just see the color. It's brown. The cover's brown. And I'm writing it. I'm writing it. It's not ready yet. I'm still working on it.
What are you working on it? What is the topic?
It's about life and spirituality and knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a Hindu?
What is your religion? That would be more.
Okay.
It's just the way. We don't have titles.
What else can I ask him?
Let's take him to... how old is he in? And let's take him forward in this life.
I'm 40.
I'm 40. Okay, I'm going to count from 1 to 3. At 3, you will be at another time in the same timeline, the same life, at another time, much further in time, that it will be a significant event, which from that event you're going to learn something that you can bring it later on into this current life. 1, 2, 3. Tell me where you are.
I'm speaking to people.
Speaking to people. And
I'm giving a speech.
The speech is about what?
It's about philosophy.
Mm-hmm. How many people are listening to you?
Oh, there's hundreds of people here.
Is he in a city, a village?
I'm outside.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a school.
Mm-hmm. And how old are you at this time?
I'm 55.
Mm-hmm. What else do you want me to ask him?
Can you take him, or can he describe his last days on
Thank you.
Earth?
Thank you. I'm going to again count from 1, 2, 3. At 3, you will be at the time that you're ready to pass from this life. You will go to, and just remember, you will see the event without any emotions. You will be able to describe it. You will basically see yourself passing from this life, and you will tell us where you're going. 1, 2, 3. What's happening? What's the event without any emotion?
I'm waiting. I'm waiting for me now. I'm waiting.
Waiting for what?
I'm waiting for me to come back.
Mm-hmm.
To come back from where?
I can see it all.
Tell us in details what you see.
It's light. It's blue.
Oh, so you left your body already, isn't it?
I'm waiting for it to happen.
Okay.
I'm watching.
And what are you feeling?
It's just peace. It's just, there's no feeling.
Is it okay for you to look backwards and see your body? And describe if there are people there, at your funeral?
I'm just above it, watching it.
Okay.
How old are you when you pass?
I'm just seeing it from above. But I'm waiting. I'm
what waiting are you waiting for?
For it to happen so I can...
And I'm going to count from 1, 2, 3. The time has come and it will happen. Whatever you meant happen. 1, 2, 3. Tell me what's all going on now.
Okay, I'm coming back.
Coming back where?
We're light. We're just light.
Thank you. Follow the light, and you will see a bigger light. Follow that light, and allow that light to take you even further. There will be an orientation place.
I'm tingling.
That's okay. That's wonderful. Your body's healing right now.
Oh, I'm tingling.
His body's healing right now. Right now he's tingling because his body, he's in another dimension right now.
And my whole face is tingling.
That's okay.
Let me just recap.
Just relax.
Paul Cuides is in studio. He is the producer of Follow the Truth, my all-day conference.
Like to help you.
And Debbie Papadakis is also in studio. Debbie is a past life regression therapist. She's going to be part of our panel at the Follow the Truth, the Conspiracy Show Summit. And Paul is undergoing a past life regression live on the air. And Debbie has taken him back to mid-18th century in India, where he appears to be to have been some sort of, I don't know, guru, spiritual advisor. And she has taken him to the moment of his death, which he is now describing.
And now he's in time between life between life. So he's above his body, about, and he's tell us what's happening right now.
My whole face is tingling. Everything is tingling in my body.
Your body is transforming right now. Your body's healing all the way. And when people go to this situation, they're healing all the way.
Can you give us details of how you passed? How did you die?
You know what? I'm going to ask him. The how to die is too past now.
We have Okay.
We have to go and see what's happening where he is.
All right.
Can we call some help? Can you call some? I don't know. I don't want to give you the words here, but who's coming to help you? Is any spiritual?
Oh, we're all here.
We're all here. And just because of time, I'm going to ask you to go further and...
Michael's here.
Michael.
I'm Michael.
Well, you're Michael. And can you describe how you look, even though...
Oh, I have wings.
You have wings.
It's okay, and everything's okay.
Everything is okay.
Who are you, Michael? What are you?
I can see myself. We're it's light. We're just light.
Uh-huh.
Why do you have wings?
I shouldn't be talking about this.
Okay.
Interesting.
You can talk only what you think is the most appropriate thing to talk, please. It's okay, we have to respect that.
We're all light, you know, yeah. And it's all okay. Our beings are just light.
Is there any place to go to learn something further?
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Oh, it's always a place to go. Yes. We're always learning. Learning is divine.
Yes.
It's all about learning.
How about your soul groups? Is it okay for you just go to your soul group and tell us how does that group look like and what is the main thing for you, who you are with regarding to your soul groups?
We shouldn't get upset.
We should not get upset. Thank you. That's a good information.
Can I ask Michael another question?
Yeah.
You have wings. Do you... I know if you can't answer, you can't answer it. Are you an angel? Are you an angel?
I shouldn't talk about this.
And I'm not going to... Please, let's not push something. When they're in this place, to talk about it is not...
Okay. All right. Thank you.
We have to respect that. Just tell us something about your soul groups.
We're friends.
Mm-hmm. How many are you?
There's two of us, and there's Michael.
Mm-hmm. And what's your purpose of your being? Your purpose of your being. Look towards the future. Look towards the past.
Tingling.
You're tingling.
You know what, Debbie? We're heading into a break, so... Why don't we get that answer when we come back, and then we'll bring Paul out of this, and we'll sort of do our live on-air debriefing. Paul Koithis is undergoing a past life regression. Debbie Papadakis,
it's okay.
Our past life regression therapist in studio, back with more of the Conspiracy Show. Paul is getting very emotional at this moment. Let's take a time out. We'll come back with more here. My name is Richard Serrett. All right, welcome back. That was just a little preview of what you could experience at Follow the Truth, the Conspiracy Show Summit coming up in November in Oshawa at the Regent Theater. And Debbie Papadakis is in studio, past life regression therapist. As I say, she'll be one of our featured guests at Follow the Truth, November the 16th. You can read a little bit more about Debbie at followthetruth.tv. Now, our subject tonight, the gentleman whose voice you heard, is Paul Koithis, who is the producer of Follow the Truth, the Conspiracy Show Summit. He's with Fireside Tartan Events. And Paul, hey, welcome.
Hi. Hey, thank you very much.
You were out. You were under.
That was wild. Yeah.
Was this your first time under hypnosis? I mean, I know you saw Debbie earlier in the week and you did sort of a pre-session, but was that your first time?
If whatever that was hypnosis, this is probably my second time. Yeah.
So the first time was with Debbie on Thursday.
Yes. Yeah, correct.
How do you feel?
Right now, I feel amazing. I got to tell you, I feel great.
Do you have any recollection of what you were talking about while you were under?
Yeah, it's, you know, again, not knowing how this really works, to be honest with you, but I can recall all of it. You know, I'm conscious during all, like I'm aware of what's happening. I'm just saying things that I wouldn't normally, you know, say, and being in two places at the same time. Pretty, it's really mind blowing. Like literally, it's really quite incredible.
You were Tom. You seemed to be a photojournalist in India, 1960. You were taking pictures of a wedding. You were describing the beautiful night sky and so forth.
Yeah, it was gorgeous. Yeah.
Have you ever been to India?
I was there about maybe 8 years ago, I think. Yeah.
We had a wedding, perchance?
No.
And any idea why the connection to photojournalism?
You know, it's funny. It was me. It looked like me. I could see this person, you know, I looked like me, but different than me. And I could see what I was wearing. I could see the camera. I could see where I was. I was a bit confused why I was there. But it was all very fleeting. You know, there was a lot of different sort of crashing images all happening at the same time. And then, of course, which is what happened the first time, I ended up in this other place, which I can't quite describe what it is, because I don't have any words for it. But the images I can see very clearly.
Paul went to a different dimension, and it's very interesting when you ask him to describe about this beings with their wings. And he says, I'm not supposed to talk about it. This happened to a number of times. This is a very sacred place, very sacred situation. And very often they will only tell you what is their most appropriate thing to say. And I can see that in the radio he will not talk about it.
Well, we should explain that the second past life that you experienced, you seem to be some sort of a holy man. Rav, was your name Rav?
Raja.
Raja,
yeah.
And people were coming to you for advice. You seemed to be some sort of a scribe or an author. You were writing a book. This was in the mid-1800s. Does this sound familiar?
70, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that one was a little more vivid, I think, than the first one. And yeah, I mean, I could see the rooms I was in. I could see the people. I knew why I was there. I was talking to people. I was writing. Yeah, absolutely.
And then Debbie took you to the last day of your life. We don't have too much detail as to why you passed, how you passed, when, but you were hovering above your body, and then you went into this other dimension you're talking about.
He went to this other dimension. Richard, when we do the sessions, these sessions are 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. So just cutting it down, even that the first break we took here for 5 minutes, He ended up in somewhere else because he's there, and then he doesn't, you know what I mean? He's not given instruction. He's the sound of the voice and everything else. And then his mind took him to something else. And it's a very short period of time. But so
let me ask you, Paul, prior to this experience, what are your views on reincarnation?
You know, apart from maybe appreciating it or understanding it at an intellectual level, you know, I really didn't think much of it. You know, I come from a family that has many different religions, you know, attached to it. Some of them are not open to the idea of past lives. Other parts of my family, you know, it's a big part of who they are. So I never really thought about it much, apart from an intellectual level. Now, having gone through this experience, so when I was coming to it, really, it was just very experimental. I was just, let's just see what happens. I think now, coming out of it, you know, it's all very, very possible. And it's funny because I've been talking to people about this for the last couple of days since I had this first experience on Thursday. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are, you know, feeling the exact same way. So it's funny. These people are sort of coming into focus now, and I'm exchanging a lot of new information. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, I can't quite describe it or explain why. But it's I was someplace else, you know. It was really quite something.
When you were in this place between incarnations, and you mentioned, then all of a sudden we were speaking to someone named Michael, who had wings, and you weren't able to speak too much. Can I ask him about it now?
No, he can. Now he can.
Sure. Were you the Archangel Michael?
You know, I don't know.
I got to go to a break. Yeah. I'm sorry. The music's kind of low here, so I got to take a time out. We'll come back and think about that.
Yes, I will.
Was Paul the Archangel Michael? We'll get to that. Debbie Papadakis in studio, past life regression therapist. She will be part of our Follow the Truth, the Conspiracy Show Summit coming up in November. We'll give you more details, and Paul will speak to that as well, because our past life regression subject tonight is, in fact, the producer of Follow the Truth, the Conspiracy Show Summit. Back with the Conspiracy Show in a moment. All right, just a few moments remain with Debbie Papadakis, our past life regression therapist. And Debbie, the website, hypnohealinginstitute.com?
Hypno-healing.com.
Hypno-healing.com. Okay. And they can find out more about the Hypno Healing Institute, the kind of work you do.
And we have all kinds of workshops coming up too in our place.
All right. So, what are you going to? What can people expect when you're at the Follow the Truth, the Conspiracy Show Summit? You're going to be up there on stage. You're going to give a presentation.
Yes. I'm going to give a presentation with PowerPoint. I'm going to talk about past life for maybe 20 minutes, half an hour, and then I'm going to take one person, maybe two, maybe three. I'm not sure. And I'm going to hypnotize them, take them back to a past life in front of everybody so they can witness it. And then I'm going to take the whole group, whoever is open. We're going to spend about 40 minutes, 50 minutes to hypnotize everybody and take them to past life and perhaps to future lives. And if they're open, we can go to this place where Paul went today, to the life between life, because it's a different kind of work, but we can do that, and we will do that. And if people are open, they will have a wonderful experience.
Now, Paul, you're kind of still a little bit dazed, was really surreal for you.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I mean, it's a profound experience.
When you approached me, you came to me and you said, "Hey, you should take the Conspiracy Show live and let's do a summit, kind of a TED Talks, kind of an idea city." Thank you, Moses. An idea city for people that are interested in alternative viewpoints, UFOs, the paranormal, conspiracy, the supernatural. You probably weren't prepared for this, were you?
No.
You didn't know what you were getting into.
I did not. And no, I did not know what I was getting into. But I'm you know, everything happens for a reason. Much like the story of this summit, you know, I think like anything that's worthwhile, there's a bit of mythology behind it, and there certainly is for this particular event. Things are unfolding the way that they're supposed to, I think.
How do you think people are going to respond when they see Debbie live in action on stage at the Regent Theater in November?
You know, it's very interesting. you know, among, you know, apart from this, you know, session, the conference has a lot of other subject matter that we're going to tackle, you know, all the things that you're talking about on your show.
Time travel, crop circles.
Absolutely.
Roswell.
And I think that there is a very quickly growing public appetite, there's an itch that, you know, people need to sort of scratch. And it's becoming the type of thing that more and more people who wouldn't normally sort of even think about this stuff are beginning to. And there's a definite, you know, Main Street kind of interest, beyond interest. You know, people are, I think, at a stage where they want to have other people around them to talk about these things and to get the kind of information to meet other people who talk about these things. How do I think people are going to react to it? The way that people always do. There's going to be some who are fearful of it and who don't think this kind of information should reach the light of day. There's going to be others who have never thought that it's been okay to talk about this kind of stuff because they may be labeled as, you know, subversive or, you know, something else. I think we're going to get a wide range of reaction, but we're going to get reaction. I think that there's a lot of people who are going to come and show up and want to meet other people and hear from these speakers. And, you know, I think the work that Debbie does is just mind blowing. Like, literally it is. You know, I feel like a changed person since I first went through our first initial meeting on Thursday. I really do.
How so? How have you changed?
I've never felt more free, more confident. You know, I had a really interesting experience. If you don't mind, I'll just explain the last 3 days. After I saw Debbie the first time on Thursday, it was a very long session, longer than I anticipated. I had about 3 hours sleep, and after that, I jumped in a car and I drove to New York City. And, you know, New York City, you know, especially during the UN General Assembly, the whole world is, you know, there. Like, you can feel everything. And the experiences I had over the last 3 days, like, everything just fell into place. I met so many incredible people. You know, things are progressing in such a way, and it was just like everything was falling into place. You know, I've literally never felt this good, you know, probably since I was a child.
And your feelings now about reincarnation, how do you feel about it?
I think it's, you know, I think it's fascinating, and I think it's, you know, there's a lot there. Absolutely. I mean, we only know such a little, you know, piece of information, you know, that we can sort of process. And when you start going through all these things, it's fascinating stuff. It really is. If you're asking me if I believe in it, yes. The answer is yes.
As a result of your regressions with Debbie?
Correct. I mean, again, I could probably appreciate it as a potential a reality at an academic level to some degree before having experienced this and having Debbie take me to these places that I've been before, obviously, or even, you know, the in-between world stuff, because it was very familiar once Debbie brought me there. And of course, again, this is all, you know, things that are, I think, meant to be. I mean, the three of us sitting around here, this, you know, console right now, sort of having this conversation about this, you know, it's wouldn't have been like imaginable 6 months ago.
Debbie, is talk to me about Paul as a subject. Is he?
He's very easy to hypnotize. He was open, very open, and in fact, he went to places beyond my expectation.
Really? What does that mean?
That means that I didn't have to work very hard. I ask question, and then he will go there instead of thinking, oh, am I in the right place? Am I answering right? Am I doing it right? Oh, because the minute you start asking questions and you analyzing it, you're getting out of it. Because to go to those stages, you cannot analyze. You cannot analyze. There is no analysis in this place.
That's my problem. I don't know if I would be a good subject because
if you allow yourself,
I have a monkey mind.
No, you don't. You just say
yes,
that, and if you continuously say you have monkey mind, you will. I'm just asking you to just play along as a game. And whatever you see, people say, well, I can't see anything. You know, every moment of the day, every moment, every second of the day, we have thoughts in our heads, okay? Those thoughts are coming out as a word, as a picture, as a vibration, frequency, energy. So if I don't see anything. I mean, the monks down in Tibet, they meditated 50 years to 20 days, to, I don't know, 10 hours, 15 hours a day to get a 1-2 minutes of nothing. I don't think none of us got this to nothing. So there is always something going on, and if we just allow and accept whatever the picture is. Here we had a situation, we think Paul is in India, and he says, no, I'm not there anymore. Do you understand that? So he is where he is, and he's accepting that. He wasn't fighting. He wasn't saying, well, let me see. This guy's asking me to go there, and now they left me for 5 minutes because we had the break, and I'm supposed to. No, he just went, wherever he went. And 1 minute he's here, the other minute he's there, the next minute he's in the between life between life. It's very interesting. This life between life, it's, I've seen people heal all kinds of problems and illnesses and all that because once, you, like he said, he's tingling because the body is allowing the information to travel. It's like when you go and have a acupuncture or something, they put the needles to allow the energy to flow. Well, the energy is flowing and the body's healing automatically.
That's what that was. I got to be honest with you. Because you were in India and you were talking about death, I thought maybe you were on a funeral pyre.
Right.
That's my – no, honestly, I thought you were being, you know, cremated.
No. Oh, right.
I'm not trying to make light of it. That's yeah. – you say, oh, my God, I'm feeling tingling.
That tingling sensation, probably the second time now that's happened, you know, the first time on Thursday, that is probably the most startling, profound thing. Like literally everything in my body was tingling. I don't know how I would make myself – you know, feel that way or tingle. Like I couldn't will myself right now to have my fingers or my face or anything tingle, you know, but everything, it was really, I've never felt that before in my life. That was incredible.
How's this going to work, okay, Debbie?
Even when I do normal work, and it doesn't have to be past life, when we clear an emotion such as anger, sadness, hurt, pain, whatever, it can be from the childhood, from now, from the womb, from past life, from genealogy, when we clear those emotions, all of a sudden the body is tingling. What's happening is the body has its own set up state, and all of a sudden we go and remove an emotion, we remove something, and the rest of the emotions are trying to travel around to basically the pathways are opening for information to come in. Quite often people feel stiff, and then you do some work and all of a sudden they feel lighter. This is 99% of my clients feel tingling with the work I do. This is not just with you. I mean, this has happened with everybody. Even when I don't do past life, I do the normal hypnotic work. We have the tingling because people feel lighter. The minute, like, people have anger, remove that anger out of them, I'm telling you, the whole body becomes lighter. And every other emotion and belief and feeling, the muscles are trying to find their new spot, a new place. I mean, today I was talking to a client of mine, Dr. Sarno, who's a surgeon, and he talks about the back. He wrote a book, all kinds about your back pain, how to heal your back pain. And he says, if you change your mind, you heal the relationships with the people around you, all of a sudden your back is not having any pain anymore. So, and this is old book, but still, I mean, the idea is there. So when we remove negativity, which is – negativity is very heavy, Richard. Negativity is very heavy. When you're feeling love, you're feeling lighter, you're lifted. When you're feeling anger, sadness, hurt, pain, guilt and all that, you're feeling down.
And the theory is that the root of these problems, it could be undiagnosed pain, the root is in a previous life.
Could be
some unresolved issue, a contract between you and another person in a previous life. And these relationships you carry from one incarnation to the next. You mentioned we're almost out of time here, Paul, but you mentioned that in one previous life when you were Raja, your father in that lifetime is now your present day father-in-law.
Yes.
Right,
which is interesting.
And it's funny because when I first met my now father-in-law, I had this feeling that he had been my father or something. And
really?
There's someone who I met recently, and the first time I met him, a friend of mine, and I felt like he was my brother. And I wouldn't be surprised if I do and explore that, if he actually was.
Amazing. Okay, so we're going to see you Sunday, November the 16th.
That's right.
The Region Theater, beautiful theater, historical building downtown Oshawa, King Street.
I'll be happy to be there. I'm looking forward.
Follow thetruth.tv for more details. Call the box office, 905 905- 1-800-721-3399. Do it first thing before you forget, tomorrow morning. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Debbie. Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Richard.
All right. And the website, again, followthetruth.tv. The website for the radio program, richardserrett.com. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. And as always, follow the truth. Hey, thanks for inviting me into your home. I have to tell you, I'm still reeling from my conversation with Dan Ritten last night on Coast to Coast. Dan is the host of Daily Planet on Discovery Canada, and he's a biologist. He loves bats, vampire bats in particular. So I'm not sure if you caught Coast last night, but Dan has this new book out called Mother Nature is Trying to Kill You, and in it he sort of pokes around into the dark side of the animal world. So much, you know, that when we hear about nature and the animal kingdom, there's a lot of anthropomorphizing going on, and aren't animals all wonderful, and isn't nature grand, and if we could only get back to the garden and so forth. Well, Dan sort of lays that bare in this book. I mean, he loves nature, and he's totally turned on by, you know, even the darker realms of the animal kingdom. But we had 3 hours kicking around some pretty amazing conversations about, well, we talked at length about the mating habits of spiders, if you can believe it, and how the female usually ends up eating the male during copulation. And we talked about forced copulation in the animal kingdom, in the duck world. I mean, how else can I describe it? There is, again, this is anthropomorphizing. It's called forced copulation, but it's kind of a rape culture in the duck world. And now I'm thinking, you know, I'll never look at a male duck again the same way. They are not the cute little, adorable little, the Affleck duck or goose that we see on TV. And to think, you know, when we come to those duck crossings, and I slam on the brakes whenever a duck crosses the road, and now I'm asking myself, why am I doing that? Those male ducks are real SOBs. And don't get me started on what happens to the poor female bed bug during copulation. It's heartbreaking. Yes, pity the female bed bug. I'm going to get Dan Riskin on this program real soon. Season 3 of the Conspiracy Show television program is, of course, well underway. Monday nights on Vision TV, 10 p.m. Eastern. In our next episode, The Water Engine. Stanley Meyer posted several YouTube videos a number of years ago, which appeared to show him operating an internal combustion engine on just water. And in fact, he claimed his water engine powered a dune buggy across the United States. And then, of course, Stanley Meyer died quite suddenly and under rather mysterious circumstances, and some say he was assassinated by agents working for Big Oil. So that's this week's episode, The Water Engine. And after you watch it, don't forget to log on to theconspiracyshow.com, which is our interactive website where you can discuss, debate, vote. And good news, we're the Conspiracy Show television program now in the U.S. Season 1 is now being televised in about 110 markets in the U.S., and it's growing, and we're getting some terrific response down there. In fact, just got some results, some data. We're number 1 in Albuquerque and number 2 in Houston in our time slot. Very quickly, I also want to mention our good friend, Dr. Douglas James Cottrell, a remote viewer, intuitive, medical intuitive, Canada's Edgar Cayce, no stranger to this program. He was just on, was it last week or the week before? He's got a miracle transformation event happening Saturday, October the 4th. That's coming up this next weekend. Saturday, October 4, 1:30 to 5 p.m. in the Wellesley Room, Holiday Inn, downtown Toronto. The Wellesley Room, Holiday Inn. Saturday, October the 4th, 1:30 to 5, and that's 30 Carleton Street in Toronto between Yonge and Church. And here's the number if you want to pre-register. You call 905-393-5104, 905-393-5104. miracle transformation event on our good friend, Dr. Douglas James Cottrell. All right, we are going to talk paranormal for the next hour and how. And it may be the most notorious and most terrifying poltergeist haunting of recent decades. It's called the Bridgeport Poltergeist, and it was seen and heard by thousands of people on one unforgettable day back in 1974. And one of the local youngsters who was sort of following the remarkable events unfold as it was covered by the local media was a then 10-year-old boy by the name of William J. Hall, and he remembers every detail, and who wouldn't? And William would grow up to become a magician and a well-known investigator of the paranormal and the unexplained. In fact, he wrote a syndicated column on those very subjects for many years in Connecticut. And Bill Hall is with us tonight to share never-before-reported interviews of the first responders and other witnesses and previously unrevealed documents and reports. And it's all detailed in a journalistic new book entitled The World's Most Haunted House, The True Story of the Bridgeport Poltergeist on Lindley Street. Bill Hall, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Delight to have you with us. So take us back. 1974, you were 10 years old. Now, first of all, how big a town is Bridgeport?
It's a good sized city. It's nowhere near anything like Chicago or anything like that. So I'd probably put it in the mid sized range. And this was a very tiny house downtown. So,
and did you know of the house prior to the events that unfolded on that day in 1974? Had you passed by the house? Were there rumors about this house prior to the news coverage?
No, not at all. No. The first many of us heard of it was, of course, on TV as the story not only hit locally, but then soon virtually went around the world. I mean, Israel, Japan, Australia, Canada, in your backyard. I mean, everywhere. So it was one of those stories that just got so much more public and spread so much farther than these things usually ever do. It was kind of like the Roswell of haunted houses, if you will.
Right. So you're 10 years old at the time. Take us back and the circumstances under which you saw the news coverage and became involved in this story.
Well, there's two parts to it. When I was 10, I saw it on TV and I asked my dad, is it real? And he said no. And that was kind of the end of it for me. I was, of course, fascinated by it, but that was about it. And many years later, even when I was writing the news column, Magic in the Unknown, I had kind of forgotten about it and never really looked into it in any sort of depth until I was having my coffee, doing what every intellectual does, reading the Wall Street News. It might have been Facebook, though. It was Facebook.
Wall Street Journal sounds better. Let's go with that.
I know, right? Yeah. And somebody said, does anybody remember? It was on one of those community papers, the community fan pages. Does anybody remember the haunted house on Lindley Street? And that's when it occurred to me, geez, I never really looked into this thing, And so I went online and started looking into it. And after about 50 newspaper articles, I was convinced that no matter what happened, real or not, that there had to be a heck of a story in here. It was least worthy of investigating. So that's when I wrote down all the names of all the people mentioned in the paper, police officers, firefighters, reporters, neighbors, onlookers, all the people that were mentioned, priests. And that's when I started calling. Of course, many of them no longer with us, but I happened upon rather quickly, in fact, police officer Joe Tomek, who was a first responding police officer. And after interrogating me like he was back on the job, he opened up and actually told me some things that he never confided in the police report or the news back then. And he had mentioned that he was forced to be interviewed after it was called a hoax a few days later, after it really hit, you know, big time in the press. And he said, you know, I don't know why they set up a conference room with the police department. They forced us to be interviewed. And there was a big investigation. He said, if you can find those people who did that, he said, then you'll find out what really happened.
Okay, so let's take us back to that day, Bill. This is 40 years ago. This is half a lifetime ago. And there are people listening who have no idea what happened in 1974 in Bridgeport. So how were the news, as the news reports were coming out, what were they saying? What happened on Lindley Street?
Well, the high level overview of it was a tiny little house, 738 square feet, real tiny. And it was mother and father, Laura and Jerry Gooden, and their little daughter, Marcy, who was 10. And when they had all this activity happen, they ended up on the porch hysterical, and they ended up getting the attention of their neighbor and good friend, who also was a Bridgeport police officer, who came over and saw chairs opening and closing and some crazy things happening. And he didn't know what to do, so he called for backup. He was off duty at the time.
Sorry, let me just jump in. You said chairs opening and closing. You mean like recliners?
Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, those heavy 1970 recliners were opening and closing in the living room on their own, and as well as some other things like the refrigerator moving and so, of course, he was he thought they were broken into when he first went in there, and he didn't know what to do. So he called for backup, and four police officers came in two cars. They didn't know what to do, so they called the fire department. The fire department came. Actually, it was 12 firemen that came, 10 firemen, two chiefs. They came. They didn't know what to do, so they called the chaplain at the fire department, and they went and got the priest and brought him there. And he basically told them something evil's here, something's not right. And so it just kept escalating. And of course, then as word gets out, between picking it up on the radio and all of the people start gathering with all these police cars and fire engines. And then of course, word quickly gets around with all these witnesses seeing things.
Yeah, then it's pandemonium. Listen, Bill, we're going to take a timeout. Stay put. We'll come back on the other side. Continue to delve into the true story of the Bridgeport poltergeist on Lindley Street. William J. Hall was then 10 years old, but he's now documented, never-before-reported interviews of the first responders and other witnesses and previously unrevealed documents. In a new book, The World's Most Haunted House, back with more on The Conspiracy Show right here. My name is Richard Serrett. Oh, also, wanted to mention, if you go to followthetruth.tv, our website for the Follow the Truth, The Conspiracy Show Summit, happening November the 16th in Oshawa, hosted by yours truly, we've posted, as we do every week, a special question on that website. Again, followthetruth.tv, find that question. Do a little research. It won't take you long. Come up with the answer to that question and call Tim, my producer, here in studio, 416-360-0740. 416-360-0740 or toll-free 1-866-740-4740. If you've got the answer, you'll walk away with a pair of tickets to Follow the Truth, The Conspiracy Show Summit. In fact, we'll take the first two callers with the correct answer. You'll each win a pair. Okay, back with William Hall, the author of The World's Most Haunted House, and we're talking about this poltergeist activity that took the world by storm back in 1974. Thousands of witnesses, independent witnesses, saw furniture flying around in this tiny little house on Lindley Street in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And let's talk a little bit about the owners, Gerard and Cora Goodwin, Gooden, rather. William, give us some insights into who these people were, because this just wasn't one sort of isolated incident. There were repeated calls for help from this couple, correct?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Actually, Laura and Jerry only called the police in 1971 and 72. It was they called their friends when this stuff really started, and then got the attention of the neighbor, the police officer, John Holsworth, who he ended up calling for backup, as well as the friends called the police. So the Goodens actually never called the police. Famous ghost hunters from the Conjuring fame. Now, the Warrens were also called in, not by the Goodens again, but by a neighbor. So they really didn't know what to do other than call their close friends. But they really were kind of the perfect couple as far as their integrity and everything. They were middle aged at the time. Jerry was an altar boy. He was a Boy Scout leader when he had no children of his own. They were just known to be good salt-of-the-earth people. He was a maintenance man at the factory. Just not a head-in-the-clouds kind of guy at all. They didn't believe in anything supernatural or paranormal. They didn't. Of course, as this stuff went on, they obviously had to face it and had all sorts of theories and questions, just trying to find out what it was. But so that's who the family were as people. They were just known to be generous, down to earth, and not the kind of people would get involved in any sort of hoax or anything like that. Which, of course, everyone knew it wasn't, especially the numerous police officers that were in and out of the house, as well as others.
Now, were news crews on the scene able to capture any of this poltergeist activity, this furniture flying around on film?
No. There were news people that witnessed it happen. But, the stuff really kind of happened very quickly. So there was a Bridgeport Post reporter there. There are, of course, radio people there that wouldn't apply there. But there were TV stations there that interviewed the family and that kind of thing a little bit. Some they let in. They didn't like the publicity, but because it was already there, they did want to get the word out that they weren't crazy. That was kind of the mission of that, because, now they're this center of attention here.
And the fact that it's being witnessed by, thousands of people. So are onlookers on the street able to see this poltergeist activity from their vantage point on the street, or are strangers traipsing through their house watching this stuff?
There were people who saw it on the street, particularly not only through the windows, but there were these two cement planter swans that they had on their porch that were seen moving on their own accord by a number of people in the crowd there. And there's a lot of people who walked away telling that story, and of course I came upon some of those witnesses, as well as the police would complain that the swans were making these guttural sounds, which I'm sure the swans weren't making it, but you know how you attribute the audio phenomena to whatever is closest nearby. So the swans were a big thing that they saw, as well as some of them, of course, did look through the window. Actually, some of them did try to go in the house. Every once in a while, somebody would try to go in the house or even get by the police, and then they'd have to be escorted out. So it really got to be a crazy mess with all those people.
I mean, that must have caused, one would think, pandemonium, like mass hysteria. If you're sitting there watching this, you know, these stone sculptures moving around of their own accord and making these guttural sounds and furniture flying around, I mean, that must have caused mass hysteria.
Yeah, I mean, there were arrests made. They had dogs there and a paddy wagon, patrol cars, police. They had the barricade, the road closed. It was really crazy, and then it really, you know, when the superintendent of the police force there at the time went, it really culminated to head when three guys tried to burn the house down while the family was in it, and that's when, you know, the hoax story came out after that. Yeah, you know, they said we've got to. With all this stuff going on, they had feared that they were already making arrests, but they had feared that this thing was just something really bad was going to happen. It was already, of course, making the superintendent look bad with all these police resources and these people. And, you know, the longer it goes on, the more people come. And, you know, from farther away they come, and, you know, the more news media comes. And, of course, once Associated Press and, you know, Reuters was there, it was game over, so to speak, you know. So.
And how were the major news gathering organizations handling this story? Was it with sort of a tongue-in-cheek treatment, or was it were they covering it seriously?
They ultimately covered it seriously, but they but most of them went into it with a tongue-in-cheek attitude until they got in and realized what was going on. Two guys from WNEB radio, local radio station at the time, went in and they thought they were going to have a good old time with it. And they were going to take some interviews and it was just going to be a real fun thing. And about 5 minutes after, you know, one of the guys said, in the testimony that he gave, he said, you know, we never took our recorders out. We left the house. He said we had absolutely nothing to do a story on. We didn't know if we even wanted to do a story. So a lot of the press, that's how they were reacting. Another reporter was in there from the newspaper, and he saw a thing of dishes fly across and make a turn on the counter. And, you know, it shocked him greatly, and he felt really bad for the family. So they were having difficulty with this job of having to report this. And of course, you know, back at the station and the newspaper offices, they, of course, wanted to make it entertaining, sensationalized and all that stuff. And these reporters were really facing the fact that this was a really serious situation with people who are really suffering. So that's a good question. They did go into it with that kind of tongue-in-cheek approach, and then quickly realized that that this really was a sad and difficult situation.
And I understand that several police reported, police now, the police are reporting seeing the kitchen refrigerator rise about a foot off the floor, and others said they witnessed a 21-inch portable TV set float above a table, then rotate clockwise in the air. Have you corroborated that?
Yes. And, you know, that's the amazing thing about this case is the documentation from the investigation is so unheard of, because some of these things that were witnessed by three or four police officers as well as firefighters, each of them were interviewed separately, describing. So you'd have six or seven people describing the same event separately, not only on audio, but also with the positions of where everybody was in the room written down on an incident sheet, one incident sheet for every incident that anyone gave in, you know, an interview or testimony on. So the kind of documentation in this case was unheard of. But, yeah, the refrigerator floated. That was seen by four policemen as well as others. I mean, priests saw it happen. The young seminarian, Paulino, who was there, saw the refrigerator float. Electrical inspector and a plumbing inspector that was called into the house, because, of course, they were checking for all the usual things. But, yeah, I mean, they, they saw, and you know, the police didn't run away. I mean, they tipped the fridge, they looked under, they looked on top, one went to the basement, looked at the ceiling. You know, they really tried to, you know, come to grips with this, you know, this unknown things happening.
As a 10-year-old, as a 10-year-old, did you go by the house? Do you remember?
No, I did not, no. And, you know, I really would have no way to unless my parents drove me by it. And my dad was not, you know, he just was not open to that kind of thing. Matter of fact, I have to commend him because he's reading my book, so which is a big stretch for him. he's actually entertaining that this thing may be true just because of all he's heard about it, you know, from me, because I played him some of the things and I said, well, yeah, listen to this. Listen to this interview, and he is at least fascinated by it, and you know that's the most I can ask because now, he's of course.
Idea that the police got together and decided that they're going to declare this as a hoax simply because they wanted to calm everybody down, because as you say, there were people trying to burn this house to the ground with the family inside. Is that what happened?
Well, it's interesting what happened. An inspector was brought into the case very late in the game, Inspector Clark, by the superintendent. And the superintendent told the inspector, you need to shut this down. You know, that was the instruction. You know, I don't care how, you need to shut it down. Got to stop. Meanwhile, Tuesday morning, so this these events happened as far as publicly. I mean, they were going on before that, but publicly, it was a Sunday and a Monday were the 2 days that were really heavy activity, as well as the media was involved at that point.
In November, Tuesday, November of 74.
In November of 74, yes, thank you. And Tuesday morning when they were having some activity and they called the police outside, please come help us, and they called for some other backup. And those officers that went in the house, they saw Marcy was on there was a TV on the carpet in the living room.
This is their adopted child. Sorry, this is their adopted child, right? Marcy is the adopted child of the Goodens.
Yes, who's 10 years old at the time. And she sticks her foot out and hits the TV and it spins. And police officer saw her do it. And said, aha. And that was the beginning of, you know, all the police at the very beginning suspected the child, because, I mean, that does happen, that sometimes the parents can't see or they don't believe it's their own child. But then when an outsider comes in, it's very, you know, it's very easy to see that it's, you know, the child doing that kind of stuff. These guys who were in the house did not see any of the activity that occurred before. So this is the first time they were in the house. So, and they saw Marcy do that. And then Marcy was pretending to make her cat talk, which really didn't fool anybody. But there were all these reports of the cat talking, too, which, again, was the audio phenomenon. I don't believe the cat was talking. There were voices. There was footsteps. There was banging on the wall. You know, there were all these things going on. And so they said, okay, well, Marcy did the, you know, the ventriloquism with the cat. She kicked the TV and she must have thrown the things off, you know, the pictures off the wall and stuff. They didn't have to get into detail, you know, because they didn't know what happened before and they really weren't interested because, you know, again, if I was them and I walked into what they did and saw only what they saw, you know, that would be your natural conclusion. So, you need, you know, and then they reported that back to Inspector Clark, who knew it was real. I mean, he had all the tests, the witnesses and the police reports, and he had all that stuff on his desk. He knew it was real and he didn't know what the heck to do with it, with the case. And he gets this call from the guys on the scene saying, hey, we saw Marcy kick the TV. And he said, ah, he's thinking to himself, this is an opportunity here, you know, where I can do something with this and close the case. So they blamed it on Marcy and called it case closed. And in fact, that inspector told one of the paranormal investigators after Jerry Sulfin from Duke University said, I'm sorry, Jerry, you know, I did the best I could with what I had. I had to close it down.
All right. Listen, Bill, I gotta take a break here. So we'll pick up on that when we come back. We'll discover that this activity did seem to start right about the time that the Goodens adopted this Marcy after the death of their own son. We'll get into all of that and much more as we discuss the world's most haunted house, the true story of the Bridgeport poltergeist on Lindley Street. William J. Hall, my guest, right here on The Conspiracy Show. William J. Hall is with us, the author of The World's Most Haunted House, talking about this remarkable, horrifying poltergeist activity witnessed by thousands, including police, firemen, and other first responders. This little tiny house on Lindley Street, and the center of this poltergeist activity may have been centered around a 10-year-old adopted girl by the name of Marcia, who was actually a native girl from Canada. So there's your Canadian connection. And she was adopted by the Goodens after the family lost their son, who I believe was 7 years old at the time. Now, so this activity began after they adopted Marcia. I understand about a year earlier, she was around 9. She was home from school for about 6 weeks because of a back injury. And that's when this all started. Is that right, William?
Well, it actually started in 1968, shortly after they adopted Marcy, and she was about 4 and a half then. But it was very, very slow, simmering kind of things, like the chair being in the wrong place, the things out of the corner of your eye. Nothing is a big activity like what happened later, and then what really started it all was every November they had these banging sounds on the inside and outsides of the walls. And it started in 1971. And in 1972, their police officer friend, Officer Holsworth, across the street suggested, why don't we record these sounds so that maybe the police or civil engineers can figure out, what they're from. So they recorded those sounds. And that tape was given to Ed Warren, and then Ed gave it to Boyce Beatty, the lead investigator on the Lindley Street case, and Boyce gave it to me. So, and those sounds are actually in the bonus section of the book where you can access and hear those sounds for yourself. So those sounds is what really started it. But you're right, as far as the big activity started after Marcy was, for about a year, she was picked on every day at school because of her olive skin. As you said, she's Native American. And then she got beat up in the cafeteria at school by a boy and was home for about 6 weeks with her overbearing mother, who was very sheltering of Marcy because their little boy, who died at age 6, that you had mentioned, couldn't walk or talk or anything. He had cerebral palsy. And so they were kind of bringing Marcy up in the same kind of way. They were afraid she was going to get killed. And meanwhile, Marcy's very introverted, withdrawn to begin with. So all of this, enters your basic, poltergeist situation within the tension in the family and the young girl. But that culminated in her 6 weeks of being at home. After that period is when it really picked up into that explosion of activity.
You mentioned a seminary student who was there and witnessed some of these things. And this seminary student apparently performed the rituals of exorcism at the house. And there was a 22-page report prepared. And in that report, we could spend 3 hours just talking about what's in that report. There's made mention of a plastic crucifix that exploded from a wall in front of witnesses, and then this is the one that sends the shivers up my spine. The family cat sang jingle bells in a frightening, inhuman voice. Have you been able to get a corroboration on that aspect of the story?
Yeah, that actually was from Father Charbonneau, a priest that arrived with the Warrens in Paulino, and he had heard that as well as the Warrens, but there were many people, including police officers, that heard the audio phenomena and attributed it to the cat. But there was a part I wanted to correct from something you said, and now I can't remember what it was.
Was it about the plastic crucifix, or mentioned a plastic crucifix exploding? I mentioned
exorcism. There was no exorcism ever done. But I believe in the police report there was, I think they said something about somebody had the power to perform exorcism, and that was all that was ever done there was, a house blessing, just to clarify that.
Good.
And they tried to get one, but of course that was the kind of thing that once it got so public, the church didn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Sure. Now, when you're hunting down these first responders now, all these years later, 40 years later, did they want to talk about it? Were they hesitant? Is this something that they wanted to forget about?
I was amazed that there only was one police officer who refused to talk about it. And I had heard from his brother that it really, really affected him, and he really didn't want to, to go public again about it. He did talk about it back then, and I had his interview from, 74, but he didn't want to really talk again. The guy at Barnes & Noble did tell me his daughter came in and bought the book for him, so I guess he decided he did want to read and find out everything that happened that was outside, of course, when he was there. But other than that, I was amazed that everybody really was quite cooperative. Officer Joe Tomic took a few phone calls to warm up, and he shared more and more as the more I talked to him, and then finally sent me the original police report that appears in the book. But yeah, I was surprised that people were so receptive. And for some, it changed their life forever. For others, they said, they don't really think about it that much. It was, the way people are, it is amazing, because it's not like in the horror movies. People react with a whole range of emotions. And most of them were trying to, discover what it was, trying to deal with the unknown part of it. But, some of the most shocking things to me are the different ways that the entities appeared. And I'd like to play you a real short audio, if that's okay.
We'll do that when we come back, Bill.
Okay.
And I'll also get you to talk about maybe some of the more revelatory interviews or conversations you had with some of these first responders all these years later. 40 years. Coming up, actually. 40 years after the poltergeist activity in Bridgeport, Connecticut, on Lindley Street. William J. Hall is here to tell all in his explosive new book, The World's Most Haunted House. Back with more here on The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away. Bill Hall stays with us, the author of The World's Most Haunted House, going back 40 years to Bridgeport, Connecticut, and some absolutely horrifying poltergeist activity, much of it witnessed by thousands of people, police, firemen, other first responders. You had a piece of audio you wanted to share with us, William. First, set that up. What is this audio about?
This is Paul Eno was one of the few surviving major witnesses to this case, and he actually had an encounter with the entities. Actually, had a shoving match with them. There was four of them. And they were these gauzy-like figures. And he described to me like that you can see them kind of like you see when you light a match and you see that blurry, you can see the blurry section above the match. It was kind of that nature. And he was a 21-year-old seminary student at the time. And his job was to watch Marcy for two reasons. One is to protect her. And in the beginning, to find out if she was, doing these things, which, of course, they quickly figured out it wasn't her. And this encounter with this entity really changed Paul's view of it. He had the old school demonology view of these things. until he actually felt it, and it started changing his viewpoint that he didn't think that it was enough to really explain it. So I just want to play his interview when I connect it with him, as he shares an encounter that he had not shared back in 74. He actually didn't talk about it for about 35 years. So here it is. It's relatively short, but I think it's a nice a snippet here.
Okay. I think a lot of people would take it. These things are supposed to be spirits that we believe they were demons, but the demons have anatomies and bone structures. I mean, I'm not a biologist. I couldn't really identify it. It was almost bird-like. The thing got around me and, you know, threw the kid across the road.
So Paul had felt anatomy and bone structure in this thing, like he says, almost bird-like, these thin bones. And it really threw him for a loop with everything he was taught, you know, about considering them as demons.
But they were malevolent. I mean, these things were malevolent. They wanted to do harm.
Well, and I wouldn't say that they're positive, certainly. But we could even say they're negative. I don't know if I would say that they're, and of course it's, you know, anybody's guess, because obviously there's a number of theories out there, but you know, we don't really know what their motives were. I mean, we can say that in picking up and throwing Marcy that obviously they're evil or negative. But because there's energies involved here, we really don't know. We don't know if something's a reaction to something. But those actions do seem very deliberate and, like you said, malevolent. I try to think of all possibilities. But I don't know if you can say they're pure evil. It's
Fair enough. But why on earth?
Especially with crowd.
Sure.
Especially what the crowd was doing.
Sure.
But, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Who is the perpetrating the evil here? But why would the Goodens stay in that house?
Well, you know, they did a lot of things that you would do in that situation. So the first night, for example, they had their friend, police officer John Holdsworth, stay overnight with them. There was another night that they were there that there was just a house full of people. So a lot of times they weren't alone. There were other times where, I mean, it came to a point where they had a bag packed and, you know, they had kind of a new normal where they had a bag packed and when things were bad in the house, they would go over, to stay with family. There were other times that they would decide to stay at the house and just have Marcy go stay with family. So they really kind of mixed it up depending on what was going on in the house. They were told by the Warrens and Father Charbonneau that the way the poltergeist operates, that if they did move, this would follow them. So
what happened to Marcia? What happened to Marcy? Where is she now?
Well, as far as we know, she was okay, and we don't know what okay means, but she was at least alive and okay as of a few years ago. And that confirmation comes from one of the witnesses who was actually a Boy Scout when Jerry was the Boy Scout leader, and the assistant Boy Scout leader was this gentleman's father. And this guy, Dennis, his brother was very close to Jerry, and he told him about Marcy's status, but he's dead now. So, you know, of course, he can't ask him what okay means. And at the time when it came up, he wasn't, of course, concerned enough to go into details. So,
but nobody knows where she is. No one knows where she is.
Well, we're told she's in Canada, so it's your job to find her.
All right. Yeah. I would gladly take that on. All right. That's my assignment.
That because she was from Canada, that she's it's quite possible she may be, you know, with a tribe there or, you know, something like that. So, I mean, I did hire a private investigation firm to try to find her. So we know she's not in the U.S. From what I hear, Canadian records are a bit different. So it's, you know, it's a little bit tougher and more expensive to track down. And,
sure.
You know, not that I think she'd want to talk, but it would have been nice to say, okay, you know, she's okay, or she has a family,
sure,
or, you know,
sure,
whatever. You know.
How long did the Goodens stay in the house?
They actually lived there the rest of their lives, because what happened is after the phenomena had settled, they did try to sell the house, even though there was no more phenomena. And it wasn't because they were scared the phenomena was going to come back, but after the entities were dissipated and the activity stopped, they still didn't want to stay there because of the people. You know, it was constant ridicule at work. It was tire slashing and, you know, the mirror on the car breaking and clothes being pulled off the line. And, you know, it was just people were just really tormenting them, and they wanted to get out of the city, but they tried to sell the house and couldn't, probably more likely because of the size versus what happened there. You know, you usually can find somebody who wants to buy a, you know, a house that had that kind of activity.
There's a huge market. There is a surprisingly huge market for that sort of thing.
Now, I don't know if there was back in the 70s, but, you know, when you have a house that's 738 square feet, that's a tough sell no matter what happened. And, you know, they wanted, I think it was $31,000 for it, and it ended up selling in the year 2000 for, I think, 21. So, you know, they had their money in it, so they had to get a certain amount, and they just couldn't sell it. So instead, they painted the house and got rid of the swans and, you know, tried to at least disguise it. Instead of disguising it, the new look hit the newspaper. So, you know, but that's why they ended up staying there, you know.
Now, I've just got a couple of minutes here, Bill. So many things, so much to cover, so little time. You're a trained magician. So as a trained magician, I mean, were you going into the story trying to maybe prove that it was a hoax, knowing how, you know, some of these effects could be manipulated, could be manufactured?
Yeah, I was thinking it most likely was not real. I mean, I was open to it, but that was my thought. And luckily, the interviews were done with such detail that I had the detail I needed in order to understand completely what they saw, not just what they interpreted that they saw, but, you know, exactly what they viewed. And, you know, because in the newspapers, you know, you hear a refrigerator floated and that's what they perceive happened. But you don't hear the play by play of, you know, what they actually saw, what lifted up first. How did it react? Did it shake? Was there rumbling? Was there sound? You know, all the questions.
Sure. Was there a moment when, whether it was during an interview with one of these first responders, that you can recall thinking to yourself, "Oh my God, this was real"?
Yeah. Some of the most compelling testimony was by Father Charbonneau. You know, being a priest and describing, you know, the formation of a shadowy figure is really compelling. But I must say, it really was the compounding effect of hearing police officer after police, you know, 8 hours of police officer interviews. And after you hear so much of it, I think like synergy, you know, the total really was overflowing with evidence. But it took about 20 hours. I remember it being about at the 20-hour mark of listening to these interviews that I was at the 150%, you know, it's real mark. Because a lot of it, you're like, well, it sounds good. Nothing tells me it's a hoax, but you're still not quite sure. You need more and more and more. And then finally you hit the mark and say, okay, well, I heard 8 hours of police interviews and I heard all these firemen, I heard the priests. And then it gets to a point where it's just, there's no question, especially with the type of things that happen. So
how did it all end? I mean, when did the poltergeist activity stop and under what circumstances?
Well, as I've learned, most of these things stop when some sort of peace and routine is restored to the family. So when Marcy was able to return to school, but a different school, she returned to Catholic school, which was not the rough kind of school that she was in before when she was beat up. Once she got back to school and got in her routine and was happier herself, and that's when the activity dissipated and never returned. And like I said, the family still tried to sell the house, couldn't, but because there was no activity, figured, okay, we can't sell the house. So, you know, they decided to stay there.
How did this change your life, if at all, Bill? Once you wrote this book, you came away a believer that all of this paranormal activity, this poltergeist activity, you know, these demonic sounding voices coming out of the cat, perhaps. I mean, how did that change your life? It must have.
Oh, yeah, boy, I'll tell you, you said it, Richard. Yes, it did change my life. I felt kind of bad with not how strict, but maybe the way I viewed people who, although I had people close to me that had their own experiences, and I didn't think they were lying, but I didn't really know what to make of it, you know, without having any sort of proof or context of it. It's difficult, you know, but it did change my view of the world, and it's a much more magical place for real for me, and it's an exciting discovery. So I'm just really happy I'm in the place I am now, because now I have the eyes of a skeptic, but the realization that there are those true things out there.
Bill Hall, I appreciate your time. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. And my website's worldsmosthauntedhouse.com.
Also the name of the book, The World's Most Haunted House. Thanks again, Bill. My thanks also to Tim Spreen. Back next week, we'll talk to a doctor who says there is no real connection between high cholesterol and heart disease. I know, that's incendiary stuff. We'll talk to him about it. Back with more next week. Hope you'll be along for the ride. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.